You're listening to Montezuma Mixtape. On the show, we provide evidence to the claim that everyone has a story to tell.
It's a story we tell around the campfire when we warm our hands and our ears are open. The story we tell on the first date to conjure laughter from across the table.
It's the story that brings the party to a huddle as the night becomes a brimming reservoir of curiosity and superstitious happenstance.
These stories are heartwarming or disturbing, God's honest truth or a load of bunk. To put it simply, these stories are good stories, moving, memorable, and repeatable.
The purpose of the show is to cultivate the stories that come from our neighbors' mouths, give them a megaphone, and show that a small town county is, without exception, full of big stories.
The second component of the show is music. Music to show how stories find new expression in other mediums and art forms that places deeper into a thatching.
Each episode there will be an original mixtape that aligns with the story, not necessarily stylistically, but thematically.
So listen close and connect the dots.
Our story this month comes by way of our program and media director here at KSJD, Tom Yoder. Tom, will you set us up with what we're about to listen to?
My name's Tom Yoder, and I met Billy Moffitt about 10 years ago. He's been a DJ at KSJD for about as long as I have, about that same 10-year span. And Billy and I have always traded stories about music that we love, particularly jazz artists. I was a jazz DJ for about 3 years here at KSJD when I first started, and so we've always shared this love of jazz. And I always go in during his show. He does a show called Choctaw Ridge on Wednesday afternoons from 1 to 3 p.m. And I always go in there and just sit down and talk with him. And sometimes he brings in some vinyl or some old jazz or something. And he's always telling these great stories about when he first heard a particular track or maybe when he played it. He's a tenor saxophone player. And he just leaves great. The context of the music is always what I enjoy talking to Billy about. And so one day I just thought, you know what, Billy, we got to get some of this on tape. We got to go into that story vault and figure this out.
Without further ado, part one of Billy Moffitt's story.
I went in the Army in 1958 and came out in 60.
I was just turned 21. Right, I just turned 21.
During the course of your basic training, you go through different little programs to decide what are your basic skills. I mean, you're in the Army, so what can you do for us, so to speak? They've got you for 2 years. They've got you to do whatever it is they want you to do for 2 years. I figured out very quickly a lot of things they would like me to do. I didn't want any part of that. But you can't just say, I don't like this. I want to go home. See you later. And I had played music in high school. I was in a jazz combo after high school. So I remember stopping in one of these sessions, and a guy asked me, he says, do you play a musical instrument? And I said, yes. And he said, would you like to be in the band? And I'm thinking, as opposed to infantry, as opposed to artillery, as opposed to something other than, you know, I said, tell me what the band's like. He said, you're going to like it a lot better than you like the other things. I said, yep, okay. Well, I always traveled with my mouthpiece in case there was a saxophone laying around. And there was. And he says, can you read music? And I said, yes. And so I put the mouthpiece in a saxophone. He says, can you play this? And I remember it was Colonel Bogey, you know, the march from over Bridge Over River Twine. I mean, they played marching bands. You know, that's what they wanted. And so he put the sheet music in front of it. And I played it. And he says, we'll let you know. Basic training is over and you get assigned to something. and that's going to be your MOS, Military Occupation Service. My military occupation service was 038. 038, look it up, it's tenor saxophone player. And I looked at that one, I looked it up, and I said, oh, this is nice, I'm going to like that. Yep, I did like it. You got assigned to the 428th Army Band, which was in Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, for, I think I was 3 months there, and then I got transferred down to South Georgia, where they needed a tenor saxophone player, and I said, well, I've never been to Georgia. And so that was the beginning of my 2 years, slightly less than 2 years, in the Army Band. The general would call up and he said, so-and-so is visiting me this weekend and I'd like a piano player and some soft music out on the lawn, da-da-da-da-da. Or my daughter's having a party and she wants da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And we'd supply whatever it was that he wanted, that the music would fit the event that he was having. And then we would play at the officers' clubs for their dances and the NCO club for their dances. And then we had a jazz quintet that would play the stuff we wanted to play. And that's why we were in the rehearsal halls. After all those jobs, the lights in the barracks and the rehearsal hall would go on 2 o'clock in the morning. And the band would play until 5:30, 6 o'clock. That's why we weren't prompt for breakfast at 7. I'm sure you'll understand.
Different hours than the rest
of
the crew.
Yeah, right. And I remember we used to take a bucket, you know, the bucket that they did the floors with. And the bass player and the drummer would always have bottles of wine. And you would just pour them in the bucket, would set it on top of the piano, and then we would just jam. Until we, could, you know, we literally couldn't play anymore.
How did you guys choose the music that you were playing at that time?
That's an interesting question. And as I recall it, and I recall it pretty well, it was more like the music chose us. It was the stuff we wanted to play, the bass player, the drummer, the piano player, who was from Dinah Washington's band, the trumpet player, who was from New York, and me, the tenor saxophone player, all seemed to be interested in a certain sound. I remember you telling me about your boy's interest in saxophone.
Yeah.
And he used the word. He said, how does it sound? That was what interested us, so that when we got together, we were looking for a certain sound. And as we heard different musicians of the day doing the same thing, reaching for that certain sound, it became apparent to us that if we got together and started playing as a unit, our individual contributions to the collective effort had a better chance of finding that sound than we did individually. And when we found it, we couldn't get enough of it. You know, So we played the type of music that we were all interested in, familiar with, knew, and couldn't get enough of. So practicing was no problem. In those days, we didn't have all the technology that we have in these days, where you could download this and download that. They didn't know what a tape deck was then. Walkman was 20 years from being invented. You know, so it was individual in individual context. Like I said, the piano player was in the band in the Army, was a good friend of Horace Silver's. And so we would get a lot of the things that they were putting out before the records came out, because it took 6 months to put a record out. So he would send the sheet music down to us. We'd be playing it and very anxious to hear the record come out after we played it. And so we got turned on in different ways. But it was similar to the ways that things are exchanged these days. Those who have interest, listen up. Here's what you're looking for. You know, the methods of delivering it were a little bit different, but it got the job done.
You mentioned earlier that you guys were also going out and doing paid gigs here and there. Why? How did that come about? Why were you going out and doing paid gigs? That seems like an odd part of being in the Army.
For the money.
Yeah. Was this money you guys earned for your pockets?
Oh, yeah. You didn't get paid. The Army didn't pay you.
Right. I mean, and they just allowed you to go do that, just go out and...
Oh, they encouraged it because they were going to the places where we were playing.
I mean, I see. So the officers were going out to these clubs and seeing you.
There
guys.
Was a jazz club in Savannah that was the talk of the town, so to speak. And we were the band if we were allowed to set up and play. The officers like to get off post and go to places like this in town. And so, of course, yes, let the band play. By all means, let them play there. And so we would play money jobs up and down the Eastern Seaboard. And we would play at the Officers Club and get paid for that. Play at the NCO Club would get paid for that because it wasn't official duty. The only thing we didn't get paid for was it was mandatory we paid one post parade a month. Play the Star Spangled Banner, the trumpet player played taps, and go back, you're off, see you next month. Well, in between that time, we'd go hustle up anything we wanted to. And it worked out real well. I mean, you know, we had they can trace it. I mean, it's 50 years ago. We had a guy in the band, right? He went to the University of Georgia for 6 months while he was in the band. That's how laxed it was. He wasn't even there. Yeah, you know, it was leave the band alone. The guy says, you leave me alone, watch this. And we didn't tell on him. Yeah. You know, it was easy duty, and I'm sure much easier than it would have been, you know, MPs cleaning our barracks before a general inspection. How they hated us, and furthermore, they couldn't do anything about it.
You know, 1958 through, did you say 1960? Somewhere in there is the years we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me, you know, those were, for a lot of people, that's the pinnacle of jazz music. A lot of things that were happening in jazz and changes that were happening in jazz. Were you guys, it sounds like you guys were really kind of right along with that, with some of those things that were going on. You were listening to artists that were recording at that time, and you were getting the sheet music before it was even out. Tell me a little bit about the environment around jazz music at that time and what was going on.
Well, just as you described, as I remember it, it was the change that was going on. The best way for me to describe that in Montezuma County about the era back, the change that was going on in jazz, would say it's similar to the change that goes on from winter to spring. You know, you're not in spring yet, but you know something new is coming. You can feel it. It's in the air. You know things are going from where they were to someplace you're not quite sure yet, but you like the path. You like the introduction of that which would formulate that change as it was introduced along. And that was probably a period over 4, 5, 6 years from mid-50s on to the early 60s where you went clearly defined from one style that had been played, been accepted, and, you know, been liked and still is today. It was that period that the change went on that elevated the whole consciousness of the jazz community and the jazz aficionados to this new, here we go again, sound. You know, and it was the sound that just took over. And so everybody was doing it or trying to do it. And then, as the case usually is with all different divisions of things, there was the East Coast Sound, the West Coast Sound. There was what we've talked about this a lot. There was the hard bop sound. And there was the West Coast bands playing the pretty stuff, all the nice melodies and the nice chords. And then there was nasty stuff going on in the back rooms in Philadelphia and the tenement buildings in Brooklyn. I lean toward the tenement buildings in Brooklyn. It's just the flavor I like. That's what it was. It was two different flavors. And both of them obviously acceptable to those who were choosing them. My flavor was clearly, you put me in Bedford-Stuyvesant with the young 16-year-old Turrentine brothers and let me go over and listen to them play, and I'll come out with some new ideas. At that time, the influences, I think to us as well as to most of the people, were the Miles Davis Quintets and Sextet, which is, you know, an historic jazz unit. There was Horace Silver Quintet. There was certainly Monk for writing. There was Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers, who was one of the engines that delivered this whole sound from where it was to where it became in the 60s. I think Art and that crowd, Blakey and Bobby Timmons and Lee Morgan and Diz, of course, and Bird had already made their mark. It was almost like these guys had been born and raised with Diz and Bird, and they say, where do we take it from here? You know, which was a challenge in itself, because Diz and Bird took it from where it was to what is this? Well, the progression continued. It's just that wherever these guys were born and raised, whatever it was they were doing with their instruments, whoever it was they were listening to, the collective influence became a sound of itself. And it was a sound that was acceptable to everybody who was looking for springtime to come. You know, this one is, now the trees are starting to bloom. Oh, here come the flowers. Oh, there are the lilacs. All this new stuff got introduced and blended itself with itself and produced the new season called spring. We call it hard bop, or, you know, whatever label you want to put on it. Jazz aficionados such as yourself, and I know you know it when you hear it.
Absolutely. You
know? And it's something that you also know comes from a certain era, and that was the era. And fortunate to, number one, not only know it myself, but being a player during that era and looking back on how it developed is an education in itself, because it's how everything else develops too.
You know, part of the chain.
It is the change. I've always thought that the seasons, as glorious as they are, it's the changes, getting into them and out of them, that really produce the buzz. I mean, tell me about fall. Tell me about the last week in September. It's
very
not quite summer and it's not quite fall yet, but it's changing from one to the other, and it's spectacular.
You've been listening to Montezuma Mixtape, showcasing big stories from a small town county.
This has been part one of our two-part episode featuring Billy Moffitt.
Here at the Montezuma Mixtape, we believe that everyone has a story to tell. If you're ready to tell yours, contact us by sending an email to montezumamixtape@gmail.com.
Montezuma Mixtape is created, produced, and hosted by myself, Greg Harple, and Ian Mott. Thanks go to our storytellers and to KSJD Dryland Community Radio.
Visit ksjd.org to find full Montezuma Mixtape episodes streaming online.
Join us again next month on May 9th on the Friday Morning Zine at 8:30 for part two of our episode with Billy.
Late 50s, early 60s, Deep South. Segregation was the word of the day.